Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, law, economics, and coronavirus. And Richard, here we are again, a week after our last conversation, and the situation around the coronavirus has become much more serious, the public reaction to it on a totally different scale. So we've got huge swaths of the country all but shut down, including the New York City area, where both of us are right now. And so let's start with that. We have government prohibitions on crowds over 500, restaurants, theaters, schools shut down, really any place where there are mass public gatherings, curfews in some places. And in parts of Northern California, you've actually got the most extreme version where people are being told to shelter in place. And Bill de Blasio suggested that could be coming to New York City as well. On social media, Richard, there has been some griping, especially from your fellow libertarians. From whence does government get the authority to just command private businesses, you can't keep your doors open? What's your answer to that question?
Oh, Lord, my answer keeps changing. Look, I have just watched myself change from being slightly bemused about all of this stuff and relatively tolerant of government power in these kinds of areas under the traditional rules to becoming more and more sort of disbelieving about the way in which this thing has escalated out of control. I just wanted to say New York is shut down. New York has 16 deaths to date. And, of course, it has many more cases, most of which will not return. It turns out that the total number of deaths worldwide attributable to this disease is essentially under 9,000, which is far lower than the total amount of deaths in the United States from the virus last year, which is estimated between 22 and 55,000. What's ironic here is most of the doomsdayers always say that the lone numbers are inaccurate because of the unreported cases of death or anything else, which would mean, in effect, that the stuff that we're talking about from last year's flu season, the high estimates would be right, at which point the comparisons to what we have now would be even more striking. And so I look at this and I say, now, why are you shutting all of this stuff down? And it turns out there's just one graph which seems to explain this, and that's this mysterious graph that goes up to a peak which shows 10 million cases and a million deaths in the United States culminating in July. And people are starting to say the reason we don't see many cases is because what's happening is it's the slow creep up in the early period, and things really don't start to get hot until you get to late April or to early May. And I'm sitting here thinking that if you look at every other epidemic that's ever happened, they don't start slowly and build up. What happens is they land with a tremendous thud. So if you go back to the Spanish flu situation, out at work in the morning, dead in the afternoon, because the virus was so powerful that it just wiped people out, and there was no interim period. If you look at the situation in China, it turns out it is not a national tragedy. It's a local tragedy for the one reason in which Wuhan was located. It's a case called Hubei, China. And looking at the latest charts, it has 3,122 deaths there, which is a very substantial portion of the total. But places like Beijing are under 30 people. So it's not as though these things even spread nationally, which leads you to believe that local responses and particularistic responses are better than global responses. So if you're trying to figure out what's going on, the reason the libertarians are becoming very upset is they see this as an abuse of government power, trying to shut down a bunch of stuff when you don't have a clear health objective to do it. If you look at the American constitutional law, you have to grit your teeth because it's always gone in exactly the opposite direction, which is the judicial function seems to have no place whatsoever when it comes to the declaration of or the cessation of any kind of emergency declaration. So the courts are out of it. And what you do is you see a kind of a coordination between public and private, state and local and national and this stuff. And what is so amazing about this to lonely libertarians like myself is there seems to be a huge public census in support of the current type of situation. You don't find lots of people rising up in protest. You see a few voices that are very uneasy about it, like my own. But in general, the number of people who self-quarantine is extraordinarily high. The number of institutions that are preemptively shut down is extraordinarily high. The federal government is actually a laggard, which I regard as a strength in this particular issue, mainly because Trump is by and large somebody who, for whatever you think about him, for better or for worse, tends not to get caught up in the, shall we say, the frenzies of the moment. You leave that to the governor and the mayor of New York City. You leave it to the governor and the mayor out in California and San Francisco and so forth. And so what I think is that the answer is you don't have a constitutional case. You don't have any other remedy. I wrote this in the Las Vegas Review Journal. When you have a catastrophe this large, there is no stimulus program that works except getting rid of the regulations that have caused the dramatic turn down in the overall marketplace. So whether it's the Fed, whether it's a stimulus package and so forth, you shrink the real base. There's no way that you can solve the particular problem of the real resources and resources by trying to transfer wealth from one group to another group, from taxpayers to particular individuals or whatever.
Richard, one of the more interesting dramas in the last week has been what's been going on in Ohio. So Mike DeWine, who's the governor there, who's a Republican, has been one of the more aggressive governors in the country in taking this on. And Ohio was set to have its primary election this week. DeWine decided to postpone it, said it was too dangerous to have people coming together in that kind of proximity. That move was rejected by a judge on Monday, the day before the election was to be held. And DeWine ignored that ruling and pushed the election back anyway. It's a public health matter. As a legal matter, does he have a defensible case there?
I would have thought if it had gone through a judicial proceeding against him, the answer would be no. But again, you know, it's this sort of hidden Trump card. He's saying it's the health issue trumps everything else. Generally speaking, I think if there's a specific order and a specific command, you're no longer in the world of vast discretion to shut things down because of undisclosed mischiefs. So I would think he would be somewhat vulnerable. But then again, you ask yourself, okay, so what's the remedy? And at that particular point, what are you going to do? You're going to throw him out of office? I don't think that's likely. You're going to basically decide to run the election next week anyhow. I think you're going to have to do that. So in the end, what happens is he just gets away with all of this stuff because all the limitations of the judicial system is so pronounced that there really is no particular remedy that you could have when somebody wants to go that way. And judges, I think, are always keenly aware of that. They do not want to be in the position, for the most part, of making orders that they know will be disobeyed because there's just such powerful political forces out there. So the traditional view is that when you're dealing with separation of powers and war and other kinds of emergencies, the courts by and large take a backseat on this stuff. And to the extent that a libertarian is trying to look for a judicial solution to what has become an enormous political and economic problem, they are going to be purely disappointed, and I am too. I mean, I've become more strident in the way in which I've talked about this stuff because, I mean, you start seeing the increase in cases, and it will obviously continue to increase for a while. But how long is a huge battle in the situation in Wuhan? Basically, it went up for about 5 or 6 weeks, and then it started to plummet like a stone. And China is basically free of new cases. Well, you look at the American projection, they're talking about a 3-month rise out of this situation, 3.5 months from the middle of March to the middle of July. That just can't be right. And you start trying to figure out what the assumptions of these models are, and you read them, and they seem absolutely wild. The British had a publication come out, I think it was in Lancet, in which they predicted that 87% of the British population would get some kind of an infection, which is an hysterically high number since there have been about 100 or 200 cases reported in Britain, and deaths, not very many. And so you then tried to say, well, where is this coming from? Well, they said, we're assuming no adaptive responses. Well, there have been huge adaptive responses already, and every one of them is going to move in the direction towards the minimization. So as far as I can tell, the basic epidemiology of this seems to say it's an unpleasant situation, but we've seen far worse. And the basic politics of this seems to be going up one level of ratcheting after another. And it turns out that an increase in 10 deaths in New York City in March counts for more than 1,000 deaths in New York State back in December or November. It just doesn't seem to me to make any sense.
So from your perspective, what you mentioned the adaptive approaches there. What's the proper way to calibrate these adaptive approaches? So you're skeptical of how widespread the shutdowns are going. So what would a more effective response look like?
Well, I mean, what you have to do is to isolate high-risk populations and tell them they're on their own. That is, I'm in that high-risk group to some extent, but it's trickier. When you get over 70, you start to go into high risk. When you go over 80, it's even higher risk. But the key reason why this is so difficult is these are aggregates, and all it does is it reflects the general weakening of persons as they get older. What it ignores is the high variations amongst individuals within these groups. And I've often said and continue to believe that if you look at a group of people at 35, there's obviously going to be some variation, but it's going to be relatively narrow. By the time you get to your mid-70s or to your 80s, there's some people who are going to be on death's doorsteps, and there are others who are still going to be out running 3 miles a day. So in that older group, it seems to me that it's the bottom tail that gets all the attention, and the top tail is probably pretty much okay. And so if you told people, look, take a risk of your health, take an assessment, look at the risk factors, see what you can do, then you would see which ones do and which ones don't need it. The deaths that took place in the Kirkland facility, I think, are now close to 40, which is about 35%, I think, of the total American deaths, give or take a bit. And these were all frail people who were hit broadside by this kind of virus without any warning. And it's not the situation that you're going to see replicated anywhere else. So I think what the government should do and what private parties should do is to give information about this. What happens is we have very aggregate data. We don't break it down by age, region, location, physical health, and so forth. If it were more granulated and you put it out literally next to every case, some kind of a description of a score, age and then the score, you'd see there's a weak but positive correlation between age and score, then I think people could start to move. So you don't have to shut down even sporting events and so forth. What you do is you announce to people, or you come in at 70 at your own risk, and if you're ill, it's really very foolish to do so. The number of people who get this disease and who die when they're under 50 is relatively tiny, and under 20, it's relatively tiny. The one exception to this is obviously newborns whose immune system is not grown, but you don't take them to sport events anyhow. And so I think the information side would do this. And as you start to basically separate out that population, as general context start to get lower, it turns out that the rate of passage will start to be lower. There's some viruses, it seems, that mutate relatively quickly, others that don't mutate at all. There's always some degree in between. But the basic tendency is if you go iteration after iteration, and these generations for viruses move very quickly, in each future generation, you see the following thing. If the virus doesn't mutate very much and it becomes very, very rigorous, like it is in parts of Italy, populations are going to be killed off and it won't spread. If it turns out that you have a virus which is more adaptable and more symbiotic with the host, it will continue to evolve so it becomes less deadly. And then, as one of my friends put it to me, it may be infinitely transmissible but thoroughly harmless, i.e. it just becomes background DNA. I have no idea exactly which this virus is. It's probably somewhere in the middle. It may well be a very different beast in Italy today, where the tolls seem to be pretty high, than it is, say, in the United States, where the tolls seem to be much lower. And even here, there are local variations. All of this stuff, I think, is extremely important. So a national solution doesn't seem to me to give anything to it. What you'd really want to do is to say, why is anybody thinking of locking everybody in place in New York City or in New York State when the death rate is so low? And it turns out that the recovery rate seems to be pretty high.
So final thing that I'll ask you about, we now know the basic outline of the financial assistance plan that's going to come out of Congress. It's probably going to cost, as you said, somewhere on the order of $1 trillion. It looks like it's going to be direct cash payments to Americans rather than something like the payroll tax cut that the Trump administration had originally floated. And the administration is also talking about, I believe, in a separate package, support for small business, potential bailouts for the airlines. Now, you said earlier, per your Las Vegas Review-Journal piece, that deregulation can do a lot more than stimulus. But what about these industries that are already sort of functionally shuttered, whether or not they should be, but movie theaters, malls, restaurants, airlines, cruise ships, places where it's not clear that deregulation, at least in the short term, is going to do a whole lot for employees who are now out of work?
Well, I mean, the tragedy is you try to calculate these numbers of dollars, and the American economy today is, what would you guess, is about $25 or $26 trillion. It turns out that this kind of a hit is probably, I think realistically, a hit that's going to already probably cost 8 to 10% of GDP and maybe even more. And this is going to continue so that if you run this thing through the next 3 months or 2 months, whatever it is, you're probably looking at a $5 trillion loss. And so whatever money you want to pay to somebody is not going to be able to cover more than a tiny fraction of what they've done. 20%. It also comes out that you have to come get this money from somebody. And this is like the sort of Modigliani-Miller theory that we use for financial assets. So what the theorem says is you've got a bunch of assets and corporations and they have a value. And what happens is if you just had a simple share situation, each shareholder would get a pro rata sense of what the total value is. But you may want to put debt on this thing. And what happens is you can put debt on this thing and you can put equity on this thing, but the number of assets don't get either larger or smaller by virtue of the change. What you hope to do is to get a better mix of people, because if you have debt and equity paper, people can now align themselves in accordance with their risk preferences, and that social gain will probably exceed the amount of transactions cost that it takes to arrange these markets. We know this works all the time. Well, that's what you're doing with the stimulus. What you're doing is you're saying to some people, we're going to make you net recipients. That means that somebody else has to be made a net payer. How are they going to be a payer? Well, it's going to be in one of three ways. You will either have an inflation, and what that will do is it will give you the stimulus dollars, and then all the dollars will go down in value so that the people who don't get the stimulus are worse off by virtue of the stimulus package, and the people who do get the stimulus are not going to be as well off as they thought they were. Or what you could do is you could add this to the national debt, but that in effect then requires somebody to figure out how you're going to pay the interest and who's going to do that, and that interest payment is essentially a lien on public and private wealth. So again, you're not getting any really strong net kind of increase. Or what you can do is you can do it through a tax program. Can you imagine trying to raise taxes now in order to give a stimulus program? It's just not going to happen. So it's going to be a combination of either the situation with new money on the one hand or borrowed money, which doesn't do anything. So we know this stuff has transactions cost. Distributional gains are extremely difficult to quantify. And so the basic reaction that I have is, A, the program is too small, and B, when you start looking at the correlative duties to the particular right, the only people when you have a program this large who can pay it are the people who are going to receive the money in any event. Then you take the size of this. I mean, you know, I've spoken to many people, and my wife in particular, and virtually every merchant she speaks to is kind of panic-stricken. You're an exercise coach. You're a dancing teacher. You give voice lessons, chess lessons, whatever it is. You run a small business, and everybody's staying out. You have a cleaner coming to your house, and all of a sudden, everybody cancels all of these orders. We're not going to be able to have a program that's going to give aid at that particular granular level to people that we're talking about. And so what is going to have to happen is something very much different from this. And this is what we call the problem of frustration, impossibility, and so forth. It's a law of contract which says you've got yourself a fixed obligation under the contract, and now you've got a vast change in social circumstances which makes performance either impossible or highly difficult to achieve. And the question is, when you alter the contract and you give excuses, who gets what benefit where? Well, you teach this stuff, which I do, and what you typically look at are isolated events. Occasionally, you see a disruption because of war. And they come up with some kind of solution that sort of works, sort of doesn't work. What is always the case about these delicate solutions is that they tend to be individually crafted to individual cases. And the moment you're trying to do a stimulus program or a sort of contract relief program, you're going to have, you know, a million cases right now, and there's no way to tailor it to individual cases, and there's no real knowledge as to what it is that you're supposed to be doing in order to deal with it. And so you're going to see this incredible mess. And what I recommend to people that they do is that they avoid trying to get into these disputes by having relaxations and postponements. So to give you the simplest version, there are hundreds of people who essentially pay next month's rents out of this month's revenues, and this month's revenues have plummeted. Well, the landlord may say, I have a right to evict. They're not going to want to evict because they're not going to get anybody else to come in given the widespread affliction on this. So they're going to have to cut a deal to reduce the rent and to lengthen the particular period. One hopes that the banks would start to come in on this stuff and give a little bit more financial assistance. But they themselves, of course, have been battered, because if you look at their loan portfolios and their stock portfolios, they've gone down as much as everybody else. Remember, the stock market has lost about a third of its value in the last 3 weeks. It's down to where it was before Trump was elected. Now, I don't blame the president for this. I don't think it should give him a disadvantage or an advantage in the upcoming election. We already hear some mightily stupid things like, oh, if we had socialized medicine, this thing would be much more easily handled. Crazy. It turns out that private enterprises are much more quick off the mark to try to figure out what kind of adaptations to be made or to be why. And then you hear some silly things like, oh, if we can afford this, which of course we can't afford, then we can afford the Green New Deal. Not if you've just wiped out the wealth that you have. And so you get this sort of progressive, it's a mantra up to the sort of saying, well, we managed to survive this, so we ought to do even more programs of this sort. And this adds something which I think is actually quite troublesome, which is the constant effort to use this crisis to advance various kinds of left-wing and progressive causes about the nature of redistribution and the nature of, you know, wealth sharing and wealth control in the United States. And the traditional view on crises is whatever you put into place in the short run, you dismantle for the long run. And now what you do is you have people saying, well, we do it for the short run, and then, of course, it's clearly better for the long run. And so one of the great consequences of this situation is not just the massive financial dislocation that we've witnessed in the last 2 weeks. It's the prospect that left and right will come together on a bigger regulatory program than we've ever had. And if the libertarians like myself are upset about what we've seen thus far, it could be just a nuclear winter that we're going to have, as this country will essentially regulate itself into poverty. There is only one way to deal with this particular crisis that has any chance of success, and that's to unwind the most offensive and the least useful regulations that we have. And everybody should start being to look at this right now. And it turns out, as best I can tell, there are a few of us who have said these kinds of things, a few doctors, a few libertarians, and a few lawyers. But rarely have I felt so utterly alone and so utterly unable to persuade people that what they're moving into is a wild and disproportionate overreaction that the numbers do not support. You cannot undo a nation in the way in which we've done it, because there have been 10,000 deaths worldwide. My best estimate, based on very little, but more than I've seen on the other side, is not that we're going to lose millions, but we'll probably have this thing top out at 3 or 4 times the current level, with the United States having its proportionate share. When I wrote my column, I said 500 words in the printed version. Actually, I should have said 500 to 1,000, but it doesn't matter. My estimates are 2 orders of magnitude below those of what's driving the current situation, and I think it's a great tragedy. It's odd to stand by your non-professional judgments, but when all the world around you seems to be going mad, sometimes it's the best that you can do.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column. It's called The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at Hoover.org. You can also follow him on Twitter, and that's at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.